Good morning and welcome to the WGTD Radio Theater. I'm your host, Steve Brown. This morning we present Brown, Thurgood Marshall and Earl Warren, A Conversation. This is the 60th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education, decided on May 17th of 1954, the landmark United States Supreme Court case in which that court declared state laws establishing separate public schools for black and white students to be unconstitutional. That decision overturned Plessy versus Ferguson of 1896, which allowed state-sponsored segregation. This dramatization uses original court transcripts, notes, letters, and also the memoirs of both Thurgood Marshall and Earl Warren, and represents well over 2 years of extensive research by both Mike Ostrup and myself. I'm very pleased and honored to introduce Cheryl Brown Henderson, who is one of the three daughters of the late Reverend Oliver L. Brown, who, along with 12 other parents, led by the NAACP, filed a lawsuit against the local Board of Education on behalf of their children in the historic case Oliver L. Brown et al. Versus the Board of Education of Topeka et al. Cheryl Brown Henderson is the founding president of the Brown Foundation for Educational Equity, Excellence, and Research. She has extensive background in education, business, and civic leadership, having served on and chaired various local, state, and national boards. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Cheryl Brown Henderson.
Thank you, Steve, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to this live broadcast of the WGTD Radio Theater. Today, I'm very pleased to introduce the world premiere broadcast of Brown, Thurgood Marshall and Earl Warren, A Conversation. I had the opportunity to see this outstanding play at the University of Missouri-Kansas City back in April as part of a 60th anniversary conference on Brown v. Board of Education, and I was impressed with not only the actors who portray Thurgood Marshall and Earl Warren, but also the scope and accuracy of the story written by Steve Brown and Michael Ostrup. As you'll hear in this performance, Brown v. Board of Education was actually made up of 5 court cases. What the Brown decision did was it broke the silence. It made the country start talking about racism and segregation and discrimination and second-class citizenship, all of which targeted African Americans in particular. Because if you look at Brown and the change that came after, like the Civil Rights Act 10 years later in 1964, the Voting Rights Act in 1965, and much earlier after the Montgomery bus boycott, which resulted in a Supreme Court decision that ended the practice of racial segregation in transportation. All of those changes emanate from the Brown decision. And now, please join me in listening to Brown here on the WGTD Radio Theater.
Good morning. I'm Thurgood Marshall, and welcome to our play, Brown. That's right, simply Brown. Brown versus the Board of Education. Today, former Chief Justice Earl Warren and I will have a conversation. A conversation all about the Brown case.
Of course, Mr. Marshall, as you and I know, this is not a simple story. In fact, this is really a tale of 3 stories: Roberts, Plessy, and of course, Brown. But more on how Roberts versus the City of Boston from 1849 and the 1896 Plessy decision fit into our conversation in just a few minutes. Many people view Brown, decided back on May 17th of 1954, as the case of the century.
That is quite true, Mr. Chief Justice. In fact, there are judicial scholars who say that Brown versus the Board of Education was the most important U.S. Supreme Court case in your tenure as chief. And let me add this. The decision that you wrote for Brown was simple to understand. It was clear. And most of all, it was elegant.
Well, Mr. Marshall, I'm not sure I would necessarily call that decision elegant, but I will tell you this. I labored long and hard to make sure that the court was unanimous in its decision.
We will, of course, get into the weeds, as people like to say today, when it comes to the details of the Brown case. But allow me for a moment to read this. Chief, these words of yours still ring clearly today and seem almost reverent, like it was just yesterday when I heard you say, "We cannot turn the clock back to 1868, when the 14th Amendment was adopted, or even to 1896, when Plessy versus Ferguson was written. The relevant question is whether segregation of children in public schools, solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities." The court's answer was, "We believe that it does."
And, Mr. Marshall, I still feel the same way. Exactly the same way. What you just quoted was certainly important. But what I said in that opinion just before those words was also quite important. And it still holds true today.
Yes, I know it does. And somehow, Chief, I knew you would remind me of what you said back in May of 1954.
There are so many attacks today on public education, I'd like to once again state what I did back then.
By all means.
Today, education is perhaps the most important function of state and local governments. Compulsory school attendance laws and the great expenditures for education both demonstrate our recognition of the importance of education to our democratic society. It is the very foundation of good citizenship. Today, it is a principal instrument in awakening the child to cultural values, in preparing him for later professional training, and in helping him to adjust normally to his environment.
Quite remarkable. It still rings true today.
Mr. Marshall, this case for which we all gather together today to discuss is of tremendous importance and certainly made a great impact on our nation. Yet, on the other hand, the principle it declared of equal educational opportunities for all races was grounded solely on the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, without benefit of any legislation by the Congress.
But, Chief, that was not the fault of the Congress, because the court, by its earlier decisions, had limited the scope of the 14th Amendment with respect to the separate but equal doctrine.
Yes, Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896.
Chief, the Brown decision attacked 3 centuries of slavery and its remnants based on the white supremacy theory.
And our decision in Brown created tremendous resentment in those parts of the country where blacks were not even accorded the right to participate in government. So, Mr. Marshall, Plessy, and separate but equal, where does that fit into this entire discussion?
How truly equal is separate but equal? And how can true equality exist between two peoples who are racially segregated everywhere they go? Apparently, this was not an issue for the United States Supreme Court when it decided Plessy in 1896. The court ruled in favor of separate areas for blacks and whites as long as they were equal, a decision that would prove to hold for almost 60 years until being overruled in 1954 with Brown.
Mr. Marshall, I would bet you, if I were a betting man, that members of our audience would like us to drill down a bit into the 5 cases that made up Brown v. Board.
I think you're completely correct, Chief. And, well, to be perfectly honest, I can't think of 2 people who could speak about these cases as you and I are able. Don't you agree, Earl?
I agree completely, Thurgood. So, on to those 5 cases?
Earl, with all due respect, I must correct you.
Really? And why is that, Thurgood?
The sixth case, decided back in 1849.
Yes, Roberts.
Correct. Roberts versus the City of Boston.
Thurgood, that's a case that many people just don't know about. And yet, it truly set the unfortunate standard of separate but equal schools for whites and blacks.
Roberts versus the City of Boston established the principle of separate but equal, and it also validated and, more importantly, institutionalized segregation in public schools.
And let's not forget that Roberts also provided the basis and rationale for the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Plessy versus Ferguson 47 years later.
Earl, when most people think of segregated schooling, they think of the American South during the first half of the 20th century. But this state court ruling in Roberts to uphold separate schools for African American children came from Boston, Massachusetts, hardly from the South.
Yes, let's consider the historical context here. The schools themselves had their origins in the late 1700s when Boston's black community asked the city to establish them, since black children who attended white schools were subjected to hostility and prejudice. At first, the request was refused. Later, white philanthropic efforts helped create such a school, and in 1820, Boston made it a part of the public school system. A second black school was established in 1831.
So, Mr. Chief Justice, with all due respect, does that mean we must blame those African-American parents who wished their children to attend all black schools as the source of the separate but equal doctrine?
No, of course not. Thurgood, as you well know, one of the attorneys for Benjamin Roberts and his daughter Sarah was Charles Sumner, who would later become a United States Senator. In his opening statement to the Massachusetts Supreme Court, he said, "Can any discrimination on account of race or color be made among children entitled to the benefit of our common schools under the Constitution and laws of Massachusetts?" This is the question which the court is now to hear, to consider, and to decide.
Unfortunately, Earl, Mr. Benjamin Roberts and his daughter, Sarah, lost their case before the state Supreme Court, even though they argued that school segregation violated the Massachusetts Constitution's declaration that all men are born free and equal. And, according to their brief before that court, free and equal meant that all were entitled to equal protection of the laws, and that equal protection forbade separating students in ways that had nothing to do with education.
Yes, quite true. Sumner and his co-counsel, Robert Morris, an African-American, stated that students could still be separated based on age or ability, but not because of race. Sumner also said that requiring Negroes to attend segregated schools deprived them of the equal protection stipulated by the state constitution.
Quite remarkable for the day. 1849. This was the first formulation of the concept that segregation itself constituted inequality and thus violated the equal protection of the laws.
But unfortunately, Thurgood, it was the Roberts case that created the terrible and incredibly harmful belief that separate but equal schools for African American students was a good thing, that it was constitutional.
It has always been true, Earl, that to understand the present day, with important issues that perplex and in many ways confuse us, we must understand and carefully study the past.
And, my dear friend and colleague, that's why we've been talking about the Roberts case.
Yes, exactly. Brown versus the board and the Roberts case are forever linked.
And this is why, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Marshall and I are laying this groundwork for our in-depth discussion of the Brown case.
Earl, it never ceases to amaze me that so many people either don't know about the Roberts case or they simply disregard it.
Thurgood, how did you create, in that incredible and logical legal mind of yours, the bringing together of the Roberts and Plessy v. Ferguson cases for your legal fight in Brown v. Board?
Well, let me tell you. Back in September of 47, I wrote a memo to all the NAACP branches about Plessy and Separate but Equal. The title was Illegality of Separate School System.
Go on.
September 1947. Some courts, lawyers, and laymen assumed that separate but equal facilities existing in 17 states and the District of Columbia are illegal, and do not violate the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. This fiction in the law has grown up as a result of certain statements appearing in decisions of the courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. And this, Earl, is where this treatise of mine takes flight, in my humble opinion.
I know. I've read it before. It set the table, Thurgood. It did so perfectly. It's the next section of your memo that has struck me as hitting at the core of the issue of segregation. So please continue.
An examination of these previous court decisions reveals that the United States Supreme Court has never specifically passed upon the validity or invalidity of segregation statutes in public schools, but has merely restated the separate but equal doctrine first advanced in Plessy versus Ferguson, which involved transportation on trains in the state of Louisiana. The NAACP is convinced that segregation statutes violate the 14th Amendment for several reasons, among which are, one, there is no scientific basis for racial classification by the states. Two, that experience has demonstrated that segregation statutes have brought about discrimination against Negroes and were never intended to provide equal facilities, but rather to set up a system of dual citizenship.
Eloquent as always, Thurgood.
Thank you.
There were five cases that were combined to create Brown versus the Board of Education. Now, I have always felt that Briggs versus Elliott from Clarendon County, South Carolina, was the seminal case. And it was the first of the Brown cases to arrive at the U.S. Supreme Court. I was not on the court at that time. Fred Vinson was the chief. But let me assure you, I followed it very closely. I did have friends back then in Washington.
Earl, as you know, even before Briggs was argued in the courts, it had already caused a major revolution in South Carolina's educational system. Let me read something from one of my memos a year or so later that I wrote for an NAACP meeting. As the case that changed the NAACP's approach to fighting segregation, and as the case responsible for the others to be heard at the same time as one of the Brown cases, and as the one case that provided the most damning evidence of the ills of segregation, Briggs had a key role in ending public school segregation and in laying the groundwork for the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s.
A key player in the Briggs case was the Reverend Joseph Armstrong, J.A. Delane. Besides being a preacher, he was also a teacher and then became a school principal in Clarendon County. He was a person who believed in the quotation by W.B. Harvey, which says, "Injustice will not forever be borne silently." J.A. Delane would not keep silent. He kept the dream alive that the African-American children of Clarendon County would receive equal educational opportunities and be able to ride to school in buses instead of having to walk 3 or 4 miles each way to school and back home again.
South Carolina's Constitution provided that separate schools shall be provided for children of the white and colored races, and no child of either race shall ever be permitted to attend a school provided for children of the other race. In Clarendon County, a public education was hard to acquire for African Americans. Most schools for African American children were overcrowded makeshift wooden structures with no indoor plumbing or heat. What little warmth they had was provided by the firewood that was gathered by the students' parents. The farming economy of Clarendon County required that children attend school only when they were not needed in the field. There were vast educational inequities between the black and white races. Educationally, African Americans attending public education facilities outnumbered whites 3-1, but they only received 1/3 of the education budget, and no funds were provided for transportation.
Plessy versus Ferguson's separate but equal was alive and well in Clarendon County, South Carolina. And then there was Harry Briggs.
Yes, Harry Briggs. Somerton residents Harry and Eliza Briggs joined with 21 other families to find a school bus suitable for their children. But frequent maintenance led them to ask the local school superintendent, R.M. Elliott, for their own bus. Surmising that the white children rode buses, the white schools in Clarendon County used 33 buses at the time for white students. The Briggs family and many others contended black students could have at least one. Elliott refused, saying black citizens didn't pay enough taxes to warrant a bus, and that asking white taxpayers to fund that burden would be unfair.
And there was the Federal Appeals Court. A three-judge federal panel heard the case in late May of 1951. In addition to Judge Waring, who would almost certainly find in favor of the plaintiffs, the other two judges were George Bell Timmerman, a segregationist who would offset Waring's vote, and Judge John Parker, who would hold the deciding vote. Parker was seen as a liberal, but one who wanted slow change. Thurgood, that's when you and your legal team used the testimony of sociologist Kenneth Clark, who argued that segregation caused severe psychological damage to African American children, giving them deep feelings of inferiority. Well, the court ruled 2-1 against Briggs and the other parents from Clarendon County. The majority only ruled that the county must make facilities equal.
I'm glad you mentioned Dr. Kenneth Clark. His doll experiment is where they asked black children to choose between a black doll and a white doll. The dolls were the same, except for their skin color, but most thought the white doll was nicer.
The questions asked of those young African American children really made, in my opinion, the Brown case.
In the experiment, Clark showed black children between the ages of 6 and 9 two dolls, one white and one black, and then asked questions like, "Show me the doll you like best or that you'd like to play with. Show me the doll that is the nice doll. Show me the doll that looks bad. Give me the doll that looks like a white child. Give me the doll that looks like a colored child. Give me the doll that looks like you."
In Dr. Clark's test that became part of Brown v. Board, he asked 16 black children in 1950 in Clarendon County, South Carolina. Of these, 63% said the white doll was the nice one, the one they wanted to play with.
Earl, you've said many times to me and others that Dr. Clark's doll test really became instrumental in how your court finally came down on Brown. And you also know, Chief, that was exactly what we wanted to happen. Putting a real story and the effects of discrimination on the face of this case. In fact, Earl, I think we should get into the actual U.S. Supreme Court case of Brown.
Yes, I agree, with one very important stipulation.
And what might that be, Earl?
That you allow me to play the role of the justices by being the one who will pepper you with questions, as they all did during the re-arguments in the Briggs case back in December of 1953.
That's fine with me.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
This is case number 101, Harry Briggs Jr. et al. Against Roger W. Elliott, Chairman et al., members of the Board of Trustees of School District Number 22, Clarendon County, South Carolina, et al. Mr. Marshall?
May it please the court. This case is here on direct appeal from the United States District Court for the Eastern District of South Carolina. The specific provision of the South Carolina Code at issue reads as follows. It shall be unlawful for pupils of one race to attend the schools provided by boards of trustees for persons of another race. The relevant provision of the South Carolina Constitution reads, "Separate schools shall be provided for children of the white races, and no child of either race shall ever be permitted to attend a school provided for children of the other race." There are two provisions of the law of the state of South Carolina under attack in this particular case. At the first hearing in the district court, before trial got underway, counsel for the appellees in open court read a statement in which he admitted that although prior to that time they had decided that the physical facilities of the separate schools were equal, they had concluded finally that they were not equal. And they admitted in open court that they did not have equality. At that time, however, we, as counsel for the appellants, made the position clear that the attack was not being made on the separate but equal basis as to the physical facilities, But the position we were taking was that these statutes were unconstitutional in their enforcement because they not only produced these inevitable inequalities in physical facilities, but that evidence would be produced by expert witnesses to show that governmentally imposed racial segregation in and of itself was also a denial of equality.
Mr. Marshall, just what is the constitutional issue at hand here?
Mr. Chief Justice, I want to point out that our position is not that we are denied equality in these cases. I think there's been a considerable misunderstanding on that point. We are saying that there is a denial of equal protection of the laws, the legal phraseology of the clause in the 14th Amendment. I say that because I think most of the cases in the past have gone off on the point of whether or not you have substantial equality. It is a type of provision that we think tends to get us into trouble. So, pursuing that line, we produced expert witnesses who have surveyed the school situation to show the full extent of the physical inequality.
But, Mr. Marshall, you, of course, remember that court did not think much of those inequalities. Am I correct?
Mr. Chief Justice, you are correct. However, those witnesses stand in the record as unchallenged as experts in their field. And I think we've arrived at a stage where the courts do give credence to the testimony of people who are experts in their fields.
Now, Mr. Marshall, you also presented in your original arguments before that federal appeals court the testimony of a Dr. Kenneth Clark. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, it is.
How did his doll test study demonstrate such injury to the Negro children?
Dr. Clark examined the appellants in this very case and found that they were injured as a result of this segregation. The district court completely disregarded that. I do not know what clearer testimony we could produce in an attack on a specific statute as applied to a specific group of appellants. The only evidence produced by the appellees in this case was one witness who testified as to, in general, the running of the school system and the difference between rural schools and consolidated schools, which had no bearing whatsoever on the constitutional question.
Mr. Marshall, where do you place the 14th Amendment in this whole discussion? Some of my colleagues on the court have raised such questions during our deliberations.
Mr. Chief Justice, and I also address this response to the other justices on this court. So, here we have the unique situation of an asserted federal right, which has been declared several times by this court to be personal and present, being set aside on the theory that it is a matter for the state legislature to decide, and it is not for this court. And that is directly contrary to every opinion of this court. If the boundary lines are drawn on a natural basis, without regard to race or color, then I think nobody would have any complaint. For example, the colored child that is over here in this school would not be able to go to that school. The only thing that would be of issue is that whatever line you set, it shall not be set on race. The children in these cases are guaranteed by the state some 12 years of education in varying degrees. And this idea, if I understand it, to leave it to the states until they work it out, I think that's the most ingenious argument. You leave it to the states, they say. And then they say the states haven't done anything about it in 100 years, so for that reason, the court doesn't touch it. The argument of judicial restraint has no application in this case. There is a relationship between federal and state, but there is no corollary or relationship as to the 14th Amendment. The duty of following the 14th Amendment is placed upon the states. The duty of enforcing the 14th Amendment is placed upon this court. We hereby charge them with making the same argument that was made before the Civil War. The same argument that was made during the period between ratification of the 14th Amendment and the Plessy versus Ferguson case in 1896. I got the feeling on hearing the discussion yesterday that when you put a white child in a school with a whole bunch of colored children, the child would fall apart or something. Everybody knows that is not true. Those same kids in Virginia and South Carolina, and I've seen them do it, they play in the streets together. They play on their farms together. They go down the road together. They separate to go to school. They come out of school and they play ball together. They have to be separated in school. There's some magic to it. You can have them voting together. You can have them not restricted because of law in the houses they live in. You can have them going to the same state university in the same college. But if they go to elementary and high school, the world will fall apart. And it is the exact same argument that has been made to this court over and over again. And we submit that when they charge us with making a legislative argument, it is in truth they who are making the legislative argument.
Mr. Marshall, is there any way whatsoever to take race out of this equation? Is it even possible?
They can't take race out of this case. From the day this case was filed until this moment, nobody has in any form or fashion, despite the fact that I made it clear in the opening argument that I was relying on it, done anything to distinguish this statute from the black codes, which they must admit, because nobody can dispute, say anything anybody wants to say, one way or the other. The 14th Amendment was intended to deprive the states of the power to enforce the black codes or anything else like it.
The final words of Mr. Marshall's in his closing arguments on Monday, December 7th of 1953 were stunning. His eloquence reverberated throughout the courtroom, and I truly believe throughout our nation. And even today, 60 years later, they are still strong, biting, true, and most of all, reflective of how far we have come, and how far we must still go. Mr. Marshall?
Thank you, sir. So, whichever way it is done, the only way this court can decide this case in opposition to our position is that there must be some reason which gives the state the right to make a classification they can make in regard to nothing else in regard to Negroes. And we submit the only way to arrive at this decision is to find that for some reason, Negroes are inferior to all other human beings. Nobody will stand in this court and urge that. And in order to arrive at the decision that they want us to arrive at, there would have to be some recognition of a reason why. Of all the multitudinous groups of people in this country, you have to single out Negroes and give them this separate treatment. It can't be because of slavery in the past, because there are very few groups in this country that haven't had slavery someplace back in the history of their groups. It can't be because of color, because there are Negroes as white as the drifted snow with blue eyes, and they are just as segregated as the colored man. The only thing that can be an inherent determination is the people who were formerly in slavery, regardless of anything else, shall be kept as near that stage as possible. And now is the time we submit that this court should make it clear that that is not what our Constitution stands for.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall.
Before the Chief Justice reads the unanimous U.S. court decision that was made on May 17th of 1954, let me add a few sidebar notes. Although Mr. Warren made sure to say that the opinion had been unanimous, when he first took the bench, the court had been deeply divided. Brown had been argued the previous term before Mr. Warren was appointed, but due to the court's indecision of the matter, it was directed for re-argument. Had the justices voted that term, the vote would have been 5-4 in favor of the constitutionality of segregation. The Chief Justice's participation seems to have been catalytic. Irresolution was replaced by unanimity. Finally, during Dwight Eisenhower's bid for the presidential nomination in 1952, Mr. Warren clearly stated he was for broad civil rights programs and the application of one law for all men. Eisenhower was evidently either unaware of Earl's statements or chalked him up as campaign rhetoric based on Earl's past record of conservative decisions. Eisenhower called the appointment the biggest damn fool mistake I ever made. However, history has proven Eisenhower wrong. And now, the court's decision. Mr. Chief Justice.
These cases come to us from the states of Kansas, South Carolina, Virginia, and Delaware. They are premised on different facts and different local conditions, but a common legal question justifies their consideration together in this consolidated opinion. In each of the cases, minors of the Negro race have been denied admission to schools attended by white children under laws requiring or permitting segregation according to race. This segregation was alleged to deprive the plaintiffs of the equal protection of the laws under the 14th Amendment. In each of the cases, other than the Delaware case, a three-judge federal district court denied relief to the plaintiffs on the so-called separate but equal doctrine announced by this court in Plessy v. Ferguson. Under that doctrine, equality of treatment is accorded when the races are provided substantially equal facilities, even though these facilities be separate. Our decision, therefore, cannot turn on merely a comparison of these tangible factors in the Negro and white schools involved in previous cases that have come before this court. We must look instead to the effect of segregation itself on public education. In approaching this problem, we cannot turn the clock back to 1868, when the 14th Amendment was adopted, or even to 1896, when Plessy v. Ferguson was written. We must consider public education in the light of its full development and its present place in American life throughout the nation. Only in this way can it be determined if segregation in public schools deprives these plaintiffs of the equal protection of the laws. In these days, it is doubtful that any child may reasonably be expected to succeed in life if he is denied the opportunity of an education. Such an opportunity, where the state law has undertaken to provide it, is a right which must be made available to all on equal terms. We come then to the question presented. Does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe that it does. To separate these students from others of similar age and qualifications solely because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. Segregation of white and colored children in public schools has a detrimental effect upon the colored children. The impact is greater when it has the sanction of the law, for the policy of separating the races is usually interpreted as denoting the inferiority of the Negro group. A sense of inferiority affects the motivation of a child to learn. Segregation with the sanction of law, therefore, has a tendency to retard the educational and mental development of Negro children and to deprive them of some of the benefits they would receive in a racially integrated school system. Whatever may have been the extent of psychological knowledge at the time of Plessy v. Ferguson, this finding is amply supported by modern authority. Any language in Plessy v. Ferguson contrary to this finding is rejected. We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. Therefore, we hold that the plaintiffs and others similarly situated for whom the actions have been brought are, by reason of the segregation complained of, deprived of the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. It is so ordered. Thurgood, we've been having this conversation for almost 45 minutes now. We have to start wrapping things up. Perhaps we can each read something that the other specifically wrote about the Brown decision.
That works for me.
Good.
This is perfect for our conversation tonight. Right to the point.
Go on.
In your own book of memoirs, first published by Doubleday back in 1977 on page 289 of this 2001 edition. Yes, I think that's a perfect place to start.
Somehow I knew you might go there.
You said this. With courage drawn from this profession of faith in white supremacy by practically every Southern member of Congress, together with oft-repeated congressional speeches that no nine honest men could possibly have come to the conclusion reached by the High Court in Brown versus the Board of Education, excited and racist-minded public officials proposed and enacted every obstacle they could devise to thwart the court's decision.
Thurgood, go on. Go ahead and read the next 19 words because you know you love this part.
You are so right, Earl. This was aggravated by the fact that no word of support for the decision emanated from the White House.
I still find it amazingly hard to believe that President Eisenhower said and did nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Were you really surprised at all of this?
All of us on the court expected some resistance from the South, but I doubt if any of us expected as much as we got.
Earl, would you be so kind as to read from your own memoirs this next section?
Certainly. It would be my pleasure. It says, I also did not believe that there would develop in my Republican Party, which freed the slaves through the Civil War and the 13th Amendment and granted them all the attributes of full citizenship through the 14th and 15th Amendments, a Southern strategy which had as its primary purpose a restriction of such rights in order to capture the electors of those states and achieve the presidency.
Sounds a bit familiar to me. I mean, almost what the current GOP has been doing with regards to the restriction of voting through voter ID laws. But then President Obama did get reelected in 2012, even with those voter ID laws in effect.
I, for one, Thurgood, thought it would have been wonderful if by the time the centennial of the 14th Amendment rolled around back in 1968, the full principle and letter of the law, as we laid out in the Brown decision, could have been reality throughout the land.
Do you really believe that, Earl? Even with the political reality at the time with the president?
Yes, I still believe that much of our racial strife could have been avoided if President Eisenhower had at least observed that our country is dedicated, firmly dedicated, to the principle that all men are created equal.
Amen to that, Earl.
And Thurgood, with Eisenhower's immense popularity, if he had only said, that black children were still being discriminated against long after the adoption of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, that the Supreme Court of this great land of ours had now declared it unconstitutional to continue such cruel practices, and that it should be the duty of every good citizen to help rectify more than 80 years of wrongdoing by honoring that decision. If he had said something to that effect, we would have been relieved of many of the racial problems which continue to plague us even today in 2014.
And as we all know, Earl, President Eisenhower only said that the court decision in Brown was a good thing, long after he left the White House.
I'll let you wrap things up here, Thurgood. That was our agreement a few moments ago.
Chief, I know you pretty darn well, and I think you have something else on your mind. Am I correct?
Yes, you are. To know how far towards equality of citizenship we have traveled since 1954, we must know from where we started at that time. The Civil War, followed by the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and then all of that came crumbling down in 1896 when the Supreme Court took us backwards in time in their horrible decision in Plessy. States could then legally and with force of law separate blacks from whites in public transportation, providing those accommodations were somehow deemed equal. Then Jim Crow and the black codes became the norm all over the South. The doctrine of separation of the races was honored to the nth degree, but the equal part of the equation was totally disregarded.
One nation, indivisible, under God, with liberty and justice for all.
Thurgood, of all the indignities endured by African Americans, the most macabre one was that blacks could not even rest in peace in the same cemetery as whites. Cemeteries in the South refused to allow the bodies of black soldiers killed in action during the Korean War to be buried in white cemeteries. It took the intervention of the federal courts to overcome this ghoulish and despicable discrimination.
As you said in your own memoirs, oppression solely because of color appears in so many unrelated forms that it is often forgotten that they all, more or less, stem from the doctrine of separate but equal, which was the real meaning of the Supreme Court decision expounded in Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896. Earl, many people despair as to the integrative effectiveness of Brown versus the Board of Education because it has not been a complete success. They fail to recognize the great impact it has made in education in other fields and in its stimulation of Congress to legislate for equal rights.
Thurgood, I am proud of what the court accomplished during my years as Chief Justice.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you for your remarkable and steadfast service to the High Court and to our nation.
Thank you, Thurgood.
Let me close our proceedings here tonight by saying this. Chief Justice Warren has always been a man who selects his words carefully, or should I say judiciously. You know, you've always been a very difficult person to follow.
With that being said, Thurgood, let me ask you a question.
Which is?
Was the Brown case the most important one in which you were involved?
Earl, sometimes I think that I, and probably other people, overestimate the importance of the Brown case. Certainly, its impact on disassembling the separate but equal foundation laid into place with Plessy was huge. And its long-term influence on the idea that all children deserve a free and appropriate public education, which put into place integrated schools as well as the basis for special education, as we know it today, was monumental. But let me add this. My good friend Lauren Miller, who wrote the book The Petitioners, the story of the Supreme Court of the United States and the Negro, back in 1966, prefaced his chapter on the Brown case with this excerpt from an old Negro spiritual. There's a better day a-coming, fare thee well, fare thee well. In that great getting up morning, fare thee well. And Miller refers to May 17th, 1954, the opinion day in Brown as that great getting up morning. And then there's Dean Pollack of the Yale Law School, who said that the Brown decision was, with the exception of the wars, the single most important government act of any kind since the Emancipation Proclamation. Of course, our story for the quest for equality does not end here. Not at all.
It's only the beginning. Racial and social inequality still exists in our country. The quest for equality for members of the LGBT community, for immigrants who come to this country, and for any group of people who are, in their own unique way, different, still continues.
Chief, as we are celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Brown decision, there are still many stories to tell about this case and the many people who played a part in making it come alive. As Juan Williams said in his 1998 book about me, subtitled American Revolutionary, before the entire generation is gone, there are still many people who want to share their role in the great drama of the Brown case. They have stories to tell. Stories that they want in the history books.
Mr. Marshall, you're correct. All of their stories vary in the details, but they all circle, as Juan Williams said, around that one critical moment in American history, like planets orbiting the sun, the momentous ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education. For it was Brown that raised the possibility of integration becoming a reality in their minds, whether they were for it or against it.
For it was Brown. In that single ruling back in 1954 that put the power of the federal government's judges, FBI agents, and even the U.S. military forces on the side of equal rights for all. It is Brown that makes segregation not only immoral, but a crime in this great nation of ours. Not just for this generation, but for all generations, past, present, and the future.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. You were a true giant, whose commitment to equality only expanded during your years of service, and you remained true to the values of freedom and equality despite the erosion of the liberal majority on the court that you helped sustain.
Mr. Chief Justice, you were always someone who could put a string of words together that were remarkable and stunning. One of my favorites was always this: Americans have one of the greatest legal systems, but not a monopoly on the sense of justice, which is universal. Nor have we a permanent copyright on the means of securing justice, for it is the spirit and not the form of law that keeps justice alive. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall.
This has been Brown, Thurgood Marshall and Earl Warren, A Conversation, written by Stephen Brown and Michael Ulstrup and directed by Vicky Dumay. Our stars, Cameron Spencer as Thurgood Marshall and Stephen Dundas as Earl Warren. Support for the WGTD Radio Theater comes from the Kenosha Law Firm of Aaliyah Dumay Dunn and McTernan, and also the Brown Ulstrup Performing Arts Foundation, located in Salem, Wisconsin. For the WGTD Radio Theater and the 91.1 Players, I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.